Position number 11748, row 10.
So, and then at that time, I got furious again. When the man came, the two Korean guards came, started beating me up. They were catch my hand. I thought they'd be punching me. But they were catch my arm, swing me around, and knock me against the wall of the room. The other will catch my arm and swing me against, and hit me against the other wall. And then they had a kind of a, I forget now what was it. Was it a rubber truncheon or what was it? Hitting me in the back. With all their bloody force. Thump, thump on my back. And I was hopping again. And I said, you think you're going to kill me? Go ahead and kill me. In between. I said, you know who am I? No, I'm just talking absolutely nonsense. I said, I'm an Afghan. I've got a tribe which I got come today, my nearest tribe, 110 people. Why did I think of 110 such me? I said, they will go to Tokyo. At one point he told me, they would kill me and nobody would know. I said, they will know. They'll find out. They'll come to Tokyo. I pronounced the word Tokyo as they did. And they'll dig you out. They'll dig you out, search for you. And they'll kill you and your descendants and your antecedents and everybody. The killers, my people, you know. They carry a feud for centuries and they'll come. I said, do you think you'll get away? They go and kill me. You threaten me by torture, pulling my nails, doing this. Come and do it. Do it and then see what can you do. And I put on a furious act. I was furious. I was angry. And then when again started beating me, it didn't have an effect on me. I didn't even feel the burning sensation. Anger. Anger saved me that day. 31st of May, 1944. And he said, all right then, sit down. So I sat down. So he sent a chit to the camp commandant. In the chit he had written, later the Korean guards told me, through a Japanese interpreter, a doctor called Jetley, IMS. They were trying to take me to their Kempothai headquarters. And Lieutenant Yamamoto, our camp commandant, said, if you want to take him out, for the first time a Japanese brought the international law for me. He said, you've got to get the request confirmed by General Yamada, the head of the prisoner of war organization in Singapore. Till then, you can't take him out. Do whatever you jolly like with him, you can't take him out. He was completely stumped, you know. So then he said, put on your clothes. I put on my clothes. Deliberately. Sat down. And the Japanese camp commandant sent glasses of tea, three glasses of tea. One for the Kempothai chair, one for the interpreter, one for me. So I was sitting like this by then.
Sitting forward.
There was a table in between. And he said, yeah, correct. He said, bring your tea. So I looked at him. May I? He said, yes, the interpreter said so. Well, no cigarette this time. Son of a bitch, I would have loved to have a cigarette, but he was puffing himself, wouldn't give it to me. So that tea was like nectar. Mouth was dry. I could have been spitting cotton, you know. It was so dry. I drank the glass of tea. And I sat with my forehead in my hand like this. He said, what are you thinking about? Quietly. I said, I'm thinking as to what has happened. Can't understand. I fought a war. I didn't get killed. And I'm a prisoner of war. And the Japanese Bushido spirit, I've been kind to your enemies. I'm having your kindness today. It's Bushido. His face grew bloodied again. But he didn't say anything. Again, this chap says, buddy, you're asking for trouble. You're a man for punishment. I said, would you keep quiet? He hasn't told you to tell me that, do you? I was angry with him. That bloody face of his used to haunt me today. If I see him, I'll kick him in the teeth, you know. So he said, it's all right. You can go back to your camp. First time he said they will not come again. And they came. This time they said they'll come again and again. You watch out. And be a risk. We come again. Check on you. I said, my God, they're not coming, son of a bitch. He said, he won't come and he came. This time he says, he's coming, he's not coming. I was quite befuddled at that time. God, it was started off, it was about 4 hours. First day was 2.5 hours. 31st of May was 4 hours. So I got up, pulled the straps of my sandal up, chaplis up, and I walked down. The two Korean guards walking with me with their rifles on their shoulders. And their faces were very expressionless, but I could see they were sympathizing with me. Koreans were also, you know, oppressed by Japanese. So I went to my camp. My men looking at me. Not bloody Korean guard was informing everybody and beating him up. The men, he said, in their own lingua franca with him. So I walked through the road into my barrack. The word had gone there. They just smiled, was really given the treatment. So I got up. I went and sat in my bunk. My orderly came with tea for me. I drank that up. It was getting dark. So Hari Bhadwaj came. Do you want to talk? I said, no. Why? I said, Hari, this is it. I really got in the neck today. Psychologically and physically, I said, but did you crack up? I said, no. What did you do? Got angry, furious. Ticked off the bloody interpreter. Told the bloody Jap, I said, my tribe will come and kill him in Tokyo. All the war is over. Defeat or no defeat. They'll come search for him and kill him. Hari Bhadwaj kept quiet. Durrani was chuckling that side. Son of a bitch, he said, he's being beaten and he's telling them, go on, go to hell. So, thing went on next morning when I woke up. And that night I wept. I wept really, you know, in my bed. Next morning, I went and had my shower, morning shower. Somebody gave me cigarettes. I puffed at cigarettes. Somebody gave me extra ration of sugar. I put sugar in my tea, drank it up. My men kept on trickling one by one. I said, no, I see myself. You go back. We were officers in this long barrack, about 12 of us, I think. And that's finished it. 44 went by. But this experience stayed with me. I repeated it in the camp in detail in 1944 and today for the first time I did it. Nobody wants to listen to me. I didn't want to tell anybody. You know, my wife, they couldn't. I wasn't good at telling them the Japs said this. They didn't know the feeling then. Today's first time that I've repeated it question by question, not 100%, but the important questions of which has some bearing on it. 44, 45. We were there. Going weaker physically. Food was short. They were refusing to give us any more rations. Even when I used to go to work regularly, so I used to get 8 ounces of rice, officer. Men used to get 10 ounces of rice, physical work. If I showed physical work, it wouldn't help, because the camp commandant would say, he went as a charge. So, in July 45, they separated us from our men and they took us to a separate camp and we were there. And we were there in very bad treatment by the Japs. And our men were in the other camps, in the same camp but the other part of it. And our doctors were there, Kanan Chaudhary was there. We were separate in the camp. Nobody was allowed to meet us and talk to us. They gave us about 6 by 4 foot plots of land to dig it and grow vegetables. The only vegetables you could grow was spinach. And the spinach seed was so much planted and replanted, it became quite coarse by the end. And we used to eat our own vegetable and 6 ounces of rice. 4 ounces, 2 ounces vegetables, and that. Plus, we were selling our watches, our socks, our things, blankets, story, and buying this dal, you know, green monkey dal with there was some proteins in it. 2 ounces of that, we used to cook and eat. Then a kind of a millet we used to eat, which used to boil in water, became like a paste. We used to swallow that. So total intake of food for us at that place were 12 ounces a day of everything. 2 ounces of this, 4 ounces of vegetables, 6 ounces of rice, 12 ounces. Then the news began to tickle that Japanese are hard-pressed, battles being given. But Chinese were terrible by then. They should give us by Japanese surrender 2 months ahead. You see? 2 months ahead, Japanese surrender. One day we're standing near that barbed wire, looking at the miserable bloody plots of land, which is to dig. And Japs would never like to see us sitting alone. When they came here to dig, run out of our camp to be in dug holes through the matting to keep us busy. An Indian was passing through, a South Indian, and shaking his hand, doing this. And then the Chinese came, he said, Japan, British, up.
Down,
well. Then we had a doctor, a Bengali doctor called Dedi Sen, he was a major, IMS. He came, we were gambling. At that time, we used to sit, we used to put guards out. If a Jap came, we used to jump through the back of our huts into our plots. And he came, he said, a big bomb had dropped in Japan, the Japs are surrendering. That was about the 2 or 3 days after the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima and thing. We said, Daddy, you're always exaggerating. Come on, bugger off. No, no, I'll forget this. I said, go off. I said, no. So he went off. Next day, I said, war is over, I think. Something is happening. So I told my orderly to cook us. By then, we have become quite selfish. Previously, we used to share everything. If we stole or bought or something. Then we were reduced to twos and threes. Our orderlies and we used to sit down and cook and boil and eat. Meat was absolutely unavailable. Flour was unavailable. Rice and vegetables. Sometime extra dal or something we used to eat. So I said, put instead of 2 ounces per head, put 4 ounces per head. Let's eat one. War is over. And I shaved myself, my cutthroat razor, gave a brush to my moustache in my G-string, sitting outside smoking my pipe, which I made like a Hubble Bubble, with a little water, 2 pies of gurgling. And tobacco ribs used to mash up, put it there, awful. So a plane came by. Came by, so flying over Singapore, and the AK guns began to shoot at him. Everybody said, go to hell. He said, war is not over. No, look, the planes are being fired at. I shouted, I said, look, the shells are bursting in this tail. Which anti-aircraft gunner will bust a shell there? They should shoot in front of it. So that created a controversy thing on that. Next day, a P-38 plane came, American, with 2 fuselages. So we gave 3 cheers. We said, all right, there we are. Japs are hiding in the camps outside. And then they were dejected and they're burning paper and we knew that the game is over. Next day, about the 20th of August, I think, the British army officers came to our camp. My CO didn't come. Colonel Julian de Milton came from the 3rd Cavalry and a few others came. No. Colonel Julian de Milton, polo player, the same commander's name I forgot, later he commanded, he was a 4-gold polo player. And very thin, gaunt, pale men appeared. They're absolutely like skeletons. Doctors, various things. And they entered and it was pathetic to look at them. Since none of them from my battalion, I didn't go out to see them. Even I just saw them from distance and I disappeared. But Hari Badwar, Captain Badwar, and Captain Thargal, as I told you about, Julian de Milton was their commanding officer. So he came, And they went and contacted him. Dargalkar had taken no part in the camp politics, except to threaten me off and on. He was a terrible kind of blimpish type. So when he saw his CO, and they organized that Julian de Wilton would automatically become the camp commandant. And he appointed Dargalkar as his adjutant. He had then simultaneous service from Sandhurst. But he was a captain still, you know. He would have gone up to command a brigade by then. So he became an adjutant. He produced a swagger stick in his hand and his shirt and trousers and his third cavalry forage cap on his head, wandering around, you, do this, do that, complete bloody thing. And I came from the worst. I said, if you leave camp, I'll court martial you. I'll put you under arrest. You stay put. All right. Finally, in the evening, this friend of mine, he was a lieutenant from Rice Corps, Supply Corps. He was a Pathan from Frontier, head of a good chap, Sanawala. He came to me, he said, I've got good news. He has got good news for me. What's the good news? The Pathan way of saying that if I give you a good news, what would you give me? I say, anything you want. He just say, my head is yours. Life and death. I said, has my brother come? My younger brother was a fighter pilot flying in Burma. Elder brother was with 6th, 13th Fighter for Rifles, but he was serving with the scouts, and he had told me before that he would go back and join his battalion because they're going overseas. He was then Captain Yusuf. He had had the first MC given to an Indian officer in 1936 in Waziristan. So I thought one of them has come. I said, Yusuf come? No. Has Baro come? No. I said, what's the good news about? He said, your uncle is safe. Mufti Nisar Rahman. He was spent time in Outram Road Jail from 1940 middle of 43. Till the end of the war in 1945. Now that makes it, I think I worked it out, 16 months. He has spent time in Outram Road Jail in his cell. And he said that Bashir Malal, as I mentioned it before, he sent word to me in the camp that he's taken him out of the jail and brought him to his house. So that neither Mountbatten, nor Dargalkar, nor Julian de Wintour could keep me in the camp. So I and Sanawala, we disappeared from the camp. We crawled under the barbed wire, took our shirts and trousers, threw it over the barbed wire, put it on there, and we picked up a cold taxi and went off to Bashir Malal's house. And there I saw this uncle of mine, poor devil. His face was swollen, but the rest of his body was very, very thin. Very, very wasted. So Bashir Malal brought out some rum, Jamaica rum. He said he had buried a lot of drinks, which he had swallowed through the occupation. 4 bottles of rum are left, and he was going to give it to me. So he gave me 2 bottles to take back the camp in me, and 1 bottle he opened to give me a few drinks. That was a very pleasant aspect of our of the Japanese defeat, because I met my relative, whom I thought would have surely died, but he was at this very notorious Outram Road Jail, where they used to keep the very, very, I mean, according to their interpretation, they're dangerous, anti-Japanese elements there. He was in that Outram Road jail cell for 16 months. And he told me some horrendous stories about it. One amusing bit that he told me was that two American pilots from a plane which was shot down over the naval base right in front of my own eyes in 1944, 1945, beginning first quarter of 45, when they started raiding Singapore with B-29 bombers, wave after wave. There's the first time we saw the B-29 bombers, whose wingspan we had heard was 110 feet wide. Length. So the first time we saw the joint aircraft. And that very day, I was working on the Singapore Causeway, which connected the mainland. And when the raid took place, the planes were coming over the naval base towards Singapore. And one of these planes, the planes were going by and they were dropping their bombs on the naval base. One of the planes, and the Japanese Navy O fighters were in full battle cry after them. I saw that one plane came down, swooped down, and was going up perpendicular under the plane. The other plane was coming towards its tail. And as they were coming towards its tail, I could see the tracer bullets from the tail gunner of the aircraft shooting at it. And within a matter of seconds, I saw the plane hit, the Japanese fighter plane hit the tail of this B-29. Was it kamikaze? Or was it because the pilot was hit by the rear gunner's bullets and he went straight to the tail? It's really something which I couldn't tell. But even if it was a kamikaze effort, my anti-Japanese mind at that time and the morale of my troops were more paramount in my mind. So I said, no, the plane was shot and it crashed into the plane. But it could have been a kamikaze, really. So, and then when the plane was hit by this fighter, I could see the plane dithering. And, first nose up and then nose straight and on down. Two parachutes came out of it. The rest of the crew was in it. And the two parachutes came out in such quick succession, and they came down, floating down, and I could see that they landed on the mainland. The wind took them away to the north a bit, towards the mainland, and they got there. And I was very sad when I saw it, very sad. My men were sad, because each time a plane went overhead, the men would get off from under the bushes and cheer, while Japanese were first hiding. And when they used to come out, the first prisoner of war they saw, who was supposed to have cheered, they would start hitting him and beating him up. But here the cheering was really a bit muted because we saw the plane shot down in front of us. And then I saw truckloads of Japanese troops coming out towards the naval, from naval base area and going along on the causeway towards the mainland. And within 2 or 3 or 4 hours, I can't recall now. They brought back one truck, one pilot was sitting in one. They had divested themselves of their uniform except in their underwear they were sitting. And they had tied up his hands in front of him. He was a blonde head he had, I think, and he was sitting down there. I began to wave my arms around a bit so they could see me, that I had seen him go down. But they were too damn shaken to look at me. So then, after some time, another truck came, and there I saw a man tussed up in a tarpaulin, and lying flat in the bottom. Well, I could see over the truck because I was sitting on high ground on a mound, which my troops are digging to make underground defenses for the Japanese. So those two chaps, and then this relative of mine told me that two of them were in the next cell with him. And one's name he said his name was McGuitnet. To this day, I recall the name. He may have misspelled the name, but they used to somehow communicate with each other through the wall, knocking at the wall, talking sometime, when they used to take their slop out of their cells. So he told me these two were very cheerful, two cheerful companions he had. With the walls, with the room separating them, the walls separating them, two different rooms. Then from there, I trudged back to the camp. Now, when I got back to the camp, it was actually according to the orders we received from our camp, from the senior officers, was we should never leave the camp. And he pointed his finger at me because he knew that the first thing I would do is to leave the camp. So he said, "You, I mean you." And he was Captain Dargalkar, who was the adjutant of the 3rd Cavalry before the surrender. He had then, by the time we surrendered in 1942, he had 14 years service. So he was 1930 commissioner from Sandhurst. And he was a typical martinet type. But still, despite his warning, I had gone out of the camp. Because by then, next day, I think, or the day before this I went out, the British officers from Changi had come. And the senior most among them was Colonel Julian de Wilton. He was the commanding officer of the 3rd Cavalry, a famous polo player. And the second commander, forget his name now, right now, he was a very famous polo player in the Indian Cavalry. And this Julian de Wilton came, and some other British officers, and some doctors from the British Medical Service, majors and lieutenant colonels and captains, they trickled the camp. They presented a very depressing sight. They were awfully thin, gaunt, pale, and sickly looking lot. So when they arrived in the camp, they immediately, Captain Dargalkar and Captain Badwar, Hari Badwar, they made a beeline for the CO. So they organized the camp again. So Dargalkar became adjutant, and Hari Badwar was his junior officer. He was running around doing all kinds of little tasks for him. And they began to knock some shape into our camp. Then as things was going on, there's another story which I would like to mention, that we used to get our news mostly from the Chinese, passing the camp, sometime meeting us at working parties outside, and they would tell us that so-and-so place has fallen, so-and-so place has fallen. For example, when the Allies were fighting in Germany, the fall of Karlsruhe and crossing of the Rhine was given us a month or two ahead of the time that Rhine has been crossed. But it took another month or two to cross the Rhine. So they were giving us exaggerated news, perhaps to keep our morale up. Then, when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when the bombs were dropped in Nagasaki, we were sitting in our barrack, and we were playing cards to while away the time. Outside, we posted officers as sentries to see if a Jap came, then they would warn us, and we would jump to the back. We have cut holes in our the mattings, to run out and sit in our gardens to work, because Japanese did not want us to sit idle. The officers were not even allowed out to go with our troops to work. As we were sitting playing cards, a major from Indian Medical Service called Major Sen, we used to call him Daddy Sen, he was a Bengali. He appeared, lifted the curtain off, which is a gunny bag curtain we had hung in front of the door of the barrack. There were no door, but he hung the curtain. He said, "Boys, good news. Japan